What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. We're here every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's WBAI.org or 99.5 FM. You can find us on Facebook, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Patreon. And please rate and review us on iTunes and join us on Patreon. And if you sign up on Patreon, you get all sorts of extra goodies and bonus content. Actually, you get an extended interview from this very episode. And to do that, you just go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And every second Wednesday of the month, we do a live taping of the show at the Brooklyn Commons. This month, we have our next live show, January 11th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. The theme will be the media under Trump. And our special guests will be Abby Martin, a journalist and creator of The Empire Files, a weekly investigative news program on Telesur English, Mike Preisner, the producer and co-writer of The Empire Files, and Nando Villa, a correspondent from Fusion. So don't forget, come out, buy yourself some nosh, some snacks, some drinks. It's always a great time. I'm here, as always, with my main man, my man, Gabe Pacheco, very funny stand-up comedian.
Hey, what's going on? I'm back in town. I'm so excited to be here, Katie.
So excited. You and know? I'm excited.
You are? You're excited for me?
I'm excited for you, yeah.
Perfect.
If you could see us now, listeners, we're like shaking.
Deep eye contact.
Deep eye contact. Shake, rattle, and roll.
Mm-hmm. We're moving and grooving.
I love it when we're grooving, cruising together. We're moving and grooving and cruising.
Well, you know, hopefully if things go, 2017 is going to be a big year, and hopefully we'll get on the road. We'll get to do some live shows.
Yes, guys, book us. Bring us your colleges.
We can take a road trip. To your college.
Take it easy. I'm just really bringing everything to the art of song today. And it's not even road trip. It's slow ride.
Yeah.
Ever since we talked about going to the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, remember Ben Jella said...
He told us we could both get a free ride.
Yes. And it's like Katie and Gabe go to grad school. I love it. It's so earnest.
Back to school.
Back to school. It's like very 1980s Ernest goes to whatever.
What's the movie with Rodney Dangerfield, Back to School?
Oh, yeah.
And Sam Kinison's his teacher. Oh, wow.
What is that?
It's called Back to School.
It is called Back to School.
That's
oh, my
it.
God.
So...
Soul Man, that's another great Back to School film. Definitely let's reenact Soul Man.
Oh, the most unfortunate. I can't believe that they really tried blackface in the 80s.
Pre-Rachel Dolezal. They were the real ones who broke the color line.
Yeah.
They should be in civil rights history books.
Sure. Well, maybe we'll get to, what is it when you go to school and you get to teach, like at Berkeley, a student-led class, and we could teach a class on using Soul Man.
Yeah.
As a problematic blackface.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to the unproblematic blackface.
Right.
That's a whole genre of literature. But we have a great show for you today. I'm going to be talking to Doug Henwood and playing an interview that we did with him. And he, as you probably know, is a writer and radio show host. And we go over the narratives that need to die and the blame game and why it is that everyone who should be blamed is actually blaming other people.
A lot of guilty finger pointing.
And not a lot of this. Now, for radio show listeners, you can't see what I'm doing. But when I say this the first time, I'm pointing outwards. And when I say not enough of this, I'm pointing a thumb at myself.
Sort of like a symbolic representation for self-reflection.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Doug Henwood, for talking to me. We're doing this special. I have a couple of names I'm considering for it. Maybe like in defense of the blame game, or let's play the blame game, or in defense of recriminations.
Well, the people who deserve the blame never want to play the blame game.
Exactly. But not only that, it's actually way more perverse and entitled than that. The people who should be blamed play the blame game, But it's a self-exonerating blame game.
Oh, yes. Well, they're always blaming someone else. But I hear a lot of people also saying, well, it's time to move on. You know, we need to fight together. Well, no, actually not, because you don't really know what you're doing unless you understand what happened.
I feel like you and I both have a bit of a mischievous side where we enjoy being able to point out to people who were cocky and condescending and entitled and enabling that they were wrong. There's some joy to that. But I'm going to be real. I would have preferred Donald Trump losing and my inability to say you were wrong, Clintonites. Like, I'm not that bad of a person. I'm not that vindictive. But there's also a really important part of the story, which you just alluded to, which is that it's not some like fun game. It's actually taking stock of what happened in order to be able to move forward productively. And I find it so hard to explain this to people. I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. It's like, if we go along with the same narrative that allowed Trump to become president, then if we keep that narrative, of course, we're not going to be able to push back against his agenda or prevent more Trumps from cropping up.
A lot of liberals and Democrats want to blame bigots. You know, it's white male bigots that are responsible for everything. Okay, I'm not sure that's empirically true. It's partly true, at least. But so what then? What do you do about that? Are they just incurably bigoted and you just wait for several decades till the demography changes? Or do you try to do something that will distract from or heal the bigotry? And I don't hear any Democrats, you know, mainstream Democrats, liberals, you know, ranging, I don't know, from Amanda Marcotte to Chuck Schumer, let's say, who have any constructive suggestions along those lines. It's just all are a bunch of, you know, homophobes and xenophobes and gynophobes, but they're just all bad people. Okay, maybe they are, but what do we do about it? Do we just live with it? I don't understand. Please tell me. And I've been trying to get some kind of answer to that question via social media, which is perhaps not the best route, but, you know, I'm not getting anything. Nothing. It's not even answers I disagree with. It's just zero. Silence.
So there's two issues, right? One is a kind of moral, ethical framework of how we see people who one would maybe describe as bigoted, and let's just say, yeah, they're bigoted, right? There's two issues, I think. One is whether or not we see them whether or not we have any empathy towards them, right? A lot of liberals have this, like, empathy disclaimer, right, where it doesn't apply to people who are poor whites, basically. And everyone else deserves empathy and a kind of structural analysis that explains why they're thinking the way that they are, right? You see this, for instance, with hip-hop or, you know, misogyny. I'm not saying that these things are unique to those to that community, but there's a lot of discussion about understanding why certain communities have more pronounced, let's say, phobias or isms, right, than another one. But when it comes to white working class people, it's just like we become conservatives. We're like totally draconian and vindictive, and there's no room for structural analysis. And in fact, that stuff gets laughed at. I mean, liberals love using economic anxiety as a punchline, right? So there's that issue. But the other issue which you're referring to is basically like, okay, and what? So let's say they are terrible garbage people, trash. I don't view them that way, but let's say we think that they are, okay? Don't we still need them to be voting for the non-racist?
Yeah, and they deserve health care too.
Well, right. So, like, exactly. I agree, but I'm more frustrated by the people who don't even think they deserve health care.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, there's odious thing of the Daily Coast where he said, you know, all you Kentucky coal miners are losing your health insurance. Good, you deserve it. Like, really. Not very constructive.
But how come we're the ones who are blamed for being non-constructive, counterproductive? I mean, like you said, the options for not dealing with, for just writing off these people as racists or bigots, the option is waiting for demographic shift, which is pretty privileged if you think that you can sacrifice these many people for this long.
Decades we're talking about.
Yeah, right? First of all, it's not how you politically organize. Like, if you want to position yourself as a person who's an intellectual and a self-indulgent intellectual, maybe, I mean, but don't pretend you're actually a political organizer, because no political organizer has been like, it's not on me to educate them. It's not on me to cater to these people.
It's not up to me to educate you, right?
Yeah, and you know what? This is terrible, but you know what this election proved? Yeah, it was.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
You hear these heartwarming stories every now and then. Like, for example, this friend of mine posted something to Facebook earlier about some alliance, and I don't know the details of it, and I want to find out more, but an alliance between striking chemical workers in upstate New York and some members of a local mosque who are under siege by local bigots. And they came together, and, like, they joined forces. There was a story after George Michael's death of an alliance between lesbians and gays and the striking coal miners in England in 1984-ish. You know, there are stories like this. It can happen. So we need to figure out how these things happen and try to reproduce them instead of jumping up and down in our soapbox and feeling superior to everyone else.
Right. Because it doesn't, the big takeaway is, like, it doesn't actually help the people. Like, the people who are, again, for argument's sake, if I only care about non-straight white men, let's just say for argument's sake, like, it's not good for them to not address the stuff that will make people realize it's not in their best interest to vote for Trump. Like, that's the most self-indulgent thing and petulant. All these things that they said about us are true about them.
Solidarity seems both ethically demanded, but also a very practical thing to aspire to.
That's a great line. I love that. Solidarity, not just ethical, but practical. Yeah. Why do we have to explain these things to people? Like coalitions? I thought everyone knew this.
The Democratic elite ran on entitlement. It was my turn, her turn, and you should vote for us if you know it's good for you. They never really felt the need to persuade. And then the only exercise in persuasion was, I'm not Trump, he's terrifying, he's a bad person. What do I have to offer you, you know, positively? Not much was on offer. We just saw the Hillary campaign veering all over the place between running against social democracy, you need skin in the game, nobody gets anything for free in America, and then suddenly she has a college tuition program. But it's never anything coherent, powerful, or, you know, easily summarizable in a good slogan. You need good slogans. But, you know, then we thought, oh, well, at least they have the political skills to get out the vote, they understand data analysis, but they didn't even do that. So they blew it in every possible measure.
One of my favorite headlines was from the Daily Mail, I think, and it was Bill Clinton so enraged after a fight about reaching out to the working class whites that he threw his cell phone from the terrace of his Little Rock penthouse.
Yes, there's a penthouse on top of the Clinton Library, which supposedly, according to the right-wing press, is where he has all his trysts.
All right. Sounds. I mean, that's a way to my heart. A penthouse on top of a library? Like, it's pretty good. It's how to get the intellectual girl. Has there been any evidence that anyone has kind of taken stock of what happened and why people lost and has been like, okay, you're right, we've learned from this?
No, I have seen absolutely none of that. And my attentiveness to the Hillary literature has receded somewhat because I've just got sick of that and it became irrelevant. But, you know, I still do pay attention and I really haven't seen much in the way of any kind of serious postmortem. And I see a lot of defensiveness, a lot of finger pointing elsewhere, but no interest in looking inwards. And, you know, I just, I don't quite understand why. Presumably these people want to win elections, they want power, they're driven by ambition and narcissism, they want to be loved and they all want to win. Yet they're not showing any signs of wanting to do those things. Now, the Democratic Party does have this structural problem. It is a party of business that has to pretend otherwise for electoral reasons sometimes. So that's what produces all this, you know, the weakness and the confusion in their message and such. But, you know, just in purely partisan terms, you look at the Republican Party, these people know how to play hardball, they know they want to win, and they will stop at nothing. And they are reprehensible and odious people. But they really do have that instinct to fight, and Democrats don't. And, you know, there is that structural issue where their loyalties are so divided, it's hard for them to speak with one voice. But on the other hand, just in purely partisan terms or personal ambition terms, why are they not trying to figure out what went wrong and do something serious to address it? So look at this fight now over who's going to be the head of the DNC, over who will succeed Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Donna Brazile at the head of the DNC. And you've got Keith Ellison, who's in many ways a very promising figure, and then being challenged by Tom Perez and a few others. Perez is a guy who wanted to race bait Bernie Sanders, but now he's running, you know, against the black Muslim guy on some kind of white identitarian grounds. It makes no sense at all, but it just seems like ruthless Clintonite ambition.
And he was in the Department of Labor.
Yeah, he's the Labor Secretary under Obama. Soon not to be, to be replaced by a fast food executive. And God, it's all so grim. But Ellison has this idea of remaking the party from the ground up and registering people to vote, rebuilding the party at the base. And the Democratic Party is in dreadful shape. You know, they just lost a presidential election, but they are pretty competitive at the presidential level. But they're doing dismally awful at the state and local level. Aside from a few big cities, which are just going to be Democratic till the end of the world, the state legislatures, the governorships, they're losing like crazy. The Republicans are very close to being controlling enough states that they could pass constitutional amendments at will. That's how dire it is. So there's a very, very serious rot from the bottom of this party. Democrats were very complacent about it during the campaign. They kept talking about...
At least something's bottom up for the Democrats.
Yes.
It's the rot.
The rot, yes. It's like termites, you know, eating the house from within. It's about to collapse. But they're so convinced there's a dumpster fire. The party's in meltdown. Da-da-da-da-da. No, it's the party in meltdown is their own. And so Ellison has at least a strategy for rebuilding from the bottom up. Perez is a top-down kind of guy, a very elitist Clintonite kind of guy. You know, he pretends to be very pro-labor, but you know, not really. We now just parenthetically see the Service Employees Union, which has been a very important part of the Democratic coalition, about to cut its budget by a third. We're under attack, so we're going to cut our budget. It makes no sense at all. But I think they want to save their money for more electoral campaigns. All the efforts to rebuild any kind of movements, the Fight for 15, which had its problems, but it was something, they seem to be pulling back from that. So you have this thing that just cannot organize any kind of base, any kind of foundation for rebuilding this party in any way. But I think the problem is that they see that there's a real deep ideological contradiction. To do this, they have to pursue very kinds of social democratic or populist policies that the leadership of the party and its funders want no part of. So here we are, the Democrats are caught in that fundamental contradiction of their existence. They have to be a business party that pretends not to be. And now I think the game in which they've been playing some con game for the last several decades, which you know, the years they became a neoliberal party, they've been playing this con game. I think that game has run out and they really don't know what to do.
So let's say you were working at the DNC. Oh, and by the way, I don't know why people are passionate about Perez. And I mean, for this is clearly in large part, right, a proxy war because Ellison was one of the few Congress people to come out for Sanders. And Sanders has endorsed Ellison as DNC chair, and also he had appointed him to the Democratic Platform Draft Committee. Jennifer Granholm is like, no games. If you like Bernie Sanders, then you're gonna love Tom Perez.
Yeah, like, right. No.
What? Wait. You really think that that's gonna fly? Like no games. You should definitely support the guy that Sanders didn't endorse against the guy who Sanders did endorse. She's been like tweeting nonstop about how great Perez.
No, it's enough to make you believe that Freud had a point when he talked about the death wish. There seems to be some kind of almost deep fundamental suicidal impulse that's taken over the party. And you stand back and look at it, they are just not equipped to fight Trump. You know, they underestimated this guy consistently. This is the guy who destroyed the establishments of two parties. He is simple-minded, brutal, revolting. You know, I'm not going to deny any of those things, but he is clever in a way, and he knows what he's doing. And he's appointed an administration that is frightfully competent. These people know what they're doing. They have an agenda. They're very well connected for the most part. And they want to do terrible things. And it's hard to see where any opposition to them is going to come from. It's going to take radicals in the streets to present any kind of challenge to these people because the mainstream of the Democratic Party, elected officials, whatever, are just not up to the task. They just they have their heads so far up that they can't even see the light of day.
So let's say you're working for the DNC, or let's say you're an organizer. What would you say are the important takeaways from this election that you would want to bring into the future? So let's say you are elected DNC head. What are the things that you'd say, because A, B, C, D happened, we have to do 1, 2, 3, 4. And if you were an organizer, what would you do? And kind of the converse of that is, what are the things that are dangerous takeaways that you see people making that would be destructive in terms of organizing and winning elections?
Well, I think the destructive thing would be to continue on the same course of raising lots of money from rich people and Wall Street, which is what, you know, Hillary did that. She spent the month of August talking to billionaires instead of going to Wisconsin to the VFW. And it's very funny to watch Obama trolling her now about what a miserable campaign she ran. What they would have to do, and I really doubt, of course, that they would do this, given the structure of American politics and the Democratic Party specifically, but what they have to do is wean themselves from elite funding and adopt the Sanders model of small contributions. It was, you know, raised a ton of money in a very short period of time. Guy came out of nowhere. and ended up running a very credible campaign based on grassroots funding because he was very appealing and he was saying things that people wanted to hear. So that's one thing. You need to break away from the elite funders and recast the funding. Be something like a membership organization, a real political party in the sense that it is in other parts of the world. And then you have to have a message that appeals to people. Some very basic social democratic things that will make people's lives better. A single-payer healthcare system, you know, free college tuition, all the kinds of things that Sanders harped on. And I think simplicity of message is really important, too. You know, Sanders had 4 or 5 points he'd make over and over again. People made fun of him for it. But that is really how you win in politics. You know, most people are not intellectuals. They don't follow political campaigns that carefully, political issues that carefully. But if you hammer away at several things that they get convinced will make their lives better and excite them emotionally, then you can win elections. So I think that just a very simple social democratic platform, higher minimum wage, better labor law, anti-discrimination measures. But I think it's also really important to emphasize the universal. We're all in this together. And like stop the micro-targeting. A lot of what people criticize as identitarian politics, some of it is about ending discrimination and bigotry, and those are all very good things. But some of it comes out of marketing. You know, it's like we're micro-targeting populations and certain demographics. That's not really what we need in politics. We need some sense that we're all in this together and that an injury to one is an injury to all. All these classic old ideas that came out of the labor movement and left-wing politics seem very relevant to the present. You know, a lot of people say all that old stuff just doesn't fit this world. I don't really understand that at all. I think it really does. We need it more than ever. People are frightened. We have a climate crisis. We have all kinds of things that should make us want to huddle together, fight together instead of fighting each other. And that kind of Sanders approach to politics and financing politics, I think, is precisely what we need on a large scale, from, you know, city council races in every city in the country all the way up to the office of president. It just seems absolutely imperative to shift to that kind of model and away from this, you know, consultant-driven, money-driven politics that the Hillary campaign really embodied. And her failure, even though she won the popular vote, we should remember that she did win the popular vote. So there is no mandate for Trumpism. But, you know, because of our electoral college, because of the idiocy of our political system, she's not going to be taking the oath of office in a few weeks. And that failure seems to be really symptomatic of the failure of that whole approach to politics. But I don't see Democrats drawing that conclusion yet.
Of course, she won the popular vote. I mean, I don't even know, honestly, how much the mandate issue matters.
Well, Bush didn't have one. He acted like he did, though.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It's like if anyone doesn't care about that, it's Trump. And yeah. No random person cares about that or even knows what that means. I mean, so much of the discussion is a discussion that we're having amongst ourselves. The difference is we acknowledge that we're
a mandate is what you get on Grindr, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. You know, you just brought something up because one of the myths that I hear a lot is that, Sanders was selling you know, like a snake oil salesman, not enough details in his programs. And you're a finance person, right? Your background's in finance.
Economics, finance.
See, I'm so into that. I'm such an expert. But that's your background and you're smart about that stuff. And what's your response to the claim that it was impossible, it never could have happened financially? What do you have to say to them?
Well, that's not the thing that political campaigns are about. Political campaigns are about broad principles and assembling coalitions. And the details can be handled later. The details of financing single payer are not that complicated. You know, plenty of countries have done it. Canada, a similar country very similar to ours, has done it. You know, the same thing with free college. I mean, you can offer the principle, the details can be worked out later. People who want details are just trying to cause trouble and sow doubt. But campaigns are not for position papers. Hillary had position papers. She had no principles. And I think if you're going to have a choice between principles and position papers, you should always go with principles.
What's the worst example of someone who's blamed the wrong person? Like, for instance, Rachel Maddow blamed third-party voters, so did Joy Reid. Krugman called Jill Stein the nader of this election. Who are some of your favorite delusional people?
Well, I think my favorite is Paul Krugman, Possibly because I expect more from them. You know, the winner of the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Science, colloquially known as the Nobel.
Although Kissinger got a Nobel Peace Prize, so we
very large grains of salt, or multiple grains of salt. But I mean, he's supposedly a serious intellectual, and not just a hack in MSNBC. And he actually blamed a conspiracy between Putin and Comey. Are you kidding me? What is wrong with you? How can you possibly believe that? I mean, he's just devolved into such a ludicrous character. Maybe I'm betraying my own snobbery, or maybe I'm too easily impressed by academic credentials, but I think that somebody like Paul Krugman should do better than accuse the director of the FBI essentially of treason in delivering the election to Donald Trump. It was just a remarkable moment. But he carries on like that. He hasn't stopped.
That's how they get you. It's like Samuel Huntington's at Harvard, so that's why he could do the Clash of Civilizations. Like, it's very stupid. And if someone who taught at a community college wrote something like that, people would laugh him, you know, out of the room or whatever. What do you say about the Comey thing? Because that's one of the few things where I think that, I mean, I think so many of the excuses, the blame the third party, blame Bernie bros, they have nothing, like no standing. The Comey thing does present to me, again, it's something she should have been immune to, but...
The timing is weird, you know, I have to say, why he wrote that letter in the last few days of the campaign, very, very strange. But on the other hand, you know, she hadn't set up a secret email server, the whole issue never would have come up. And, you know, people say, oh, who cares about the emails? No, they came out of something that is deep within Hillary Clinton, the secretiveness, the duplicity, the desire to avoid scrutiny. So the timing of Comey's correspondence was very strange. But on the other hand, you know, there's almost an element of a classic tragedy here. She is undone by her own tragic flaw.
I think so, too. The other thing that really annoyed me about this campaign was all of a sudden it wasn't like the rules didn't apply. All of a sudden, you don't have to have charisma. You don't have to be a good politician, a good candidate. It's all about what, like you said, it's the entitlement. It's what she deserves. And I actually, as you know, we've talked about this, I'm more sympathetic to her than most people who have my political outlook, in that I do see there's something really unfair. Like, why can't she get something? Why can't she be just as entitled as every other straight white male in politics? But I didn't support her for that reason. I was talking to someone, they were like, well, it's not her fault that she's not a natural politician. I'm like, sure, but it also means that she shouldn't be the nominee or the candidate, right? Like, all of a sudden, for the first time ever, we expect Americans to be voting based on, like, serious critique policy and not at all on the way the politician comes across.
Well, I mean, she used to send out these, press emails endorsed by 100 Nobel Prize winners. Look, who cares about that? When you're running against a moron like Trump, a skilled moron like Trump, all the Nobel Prize winners in the world are not going to help you. That's not something that moves people. You know, she's also married to one of the greatest politicians of our time, right? So he was masterful at it. And the contrast does not serve her well. She's very smart. She's very skilled. She knows a lot about everything. I can't take that away from her. But she just didn't have that the political skills to sell her message. It's interesting what Biden said recently, that in some sense her heart really wasn't in it. She did feel like it was her turn, but she didn't have a really underlying justification for why she was running, other than that. And I don't think she and Biden necessarily liked each other very much. It's clear that she and Obama don't like each other very much. But I think there's something to that, that there was none of that kind of passion that actually drives someone who is a successful politician. And also that kind of, I think Bill Clinton's unruly libido probably has something to do with his skill as a politician. There is a passion to him that allows him to connect with people that just didn't work with her. And I know it's far more problematic for a woman to exude that kind of libido. I understand that. But, you know, it is a problem in a political candidate not to have that exuberance, that sociability that, you know, are really prerequisites for being a politician.
Right. It's somewhat chicken and egg probably too, right? I think he's more charismatic and passionate, so that also makes him more successful with women, blah, blah, blah. But I think that another interesting thing is that it's funny how all these people who are saying Bernie couldn't have won because he's a Jew would find it very offensive and problematic to say, no, we shouldn't have Hillary be the nominee because she's a woman and there's so much sex.
That's true. I'm not sure I buy that thing about Bernie being a Jew. I'm sure there are a lot of people who don't care at all. But
Obama, people thought he was Muslim and he is black and his middle name is Hussein. Those are all things that are true, right? I mean, not that he's Muslim, but that people thought he was. the idea that this Jewish guy, I mean, I guess I obviously disagree with that, but I just also find it so hypocritical. Like, there's such an overt hypocrisy this time around where it's sexist to say that Hillary being a woman makes her a weak nominee, but it's totally fine and not anti-Semitic to say that Bernie being a Jew makes him a weak nominee.
Well, I think there was some covert anti-Semitism to some of the critiques of Bernie. I mean, his manner, you know, he's like, you know, 75-year-old Jewish guy from Brooklyn. He looks that way. He acts that way. He talks that way. And I love him for it. And obviously a lot of people loved him for it. I mean, that's one of the reasons, that was part of this his authenticity shtick. It worked very, very well. And that's why he connected with people. This is a guy who's not lying to you. He's not, you know, marketing consultants are not telling him what to say. He's saying things that come from the heart. He feels passionate about it. You know, it showed. And that's where his being a Jewish guy from Brooklyn from the 1930s, you know, really served him.
What do you say to the other myth, which is that he was unelectable, the communism stuff would have gotten him, the Jewish stuff?
You know, who knows? Who knows? It seems very likely he could have carried the demographic or a substantial portion of the demographic that Hillary had such a problem with. The, you know, working class white people liked him. Maybe not as many as would have liked Trump, but enough to have made a difference, perhaps. So, I don't know. Who knows? But he certainly did awfully well in the primaries, better than anybody could have imagined. And it would have been a fascinating campaign to see him fighting with Trump. It would have been about something. There would have been some real, real issues raised there instead of the painfully stupid campaign we had instead.
I was talking to someone who said that, you know, she's also Jewish, so we can say things like this. You can too, because you're honorary, but that, you know, Trump is like an honorary Jew in some types. He's like the worst Jew. Like, he is an archetype of a bad Jew, and Bernie is an archetype of the best Jew. And if they had run against each other, it would have been a fascinating Jew-on-Jew election.
Well, it would have been a certain, you know, New York personality thing.
Sure.
Brooklyn versus Queens, too. Like, these guys in the crosstown bus arguing.
Totally. And then Joel Benenson. Get out of here, Joel Benenson, when he said that thing about Bernie being from, what do you say about him being from Brooklyn? I'll get it in later. But of course, Joel Benenson is from Queens, so don't pretend like you're a neutral observer, Joel.
The Battle of Newtown Creek, you know?
So that's one. Okay, we got that myth. Okay, here's another one, that we are the ones who are fighting and relitigating the primary while the Clinton people want to move on. You know, one of the things that I actually think needs relitigating, or not relitigating, litigating, because it hasn't been litigated, is the Bernie bro myth. And where it comes from, and that it's not actually true. And it's hard for me to explain to people, kind of hard, but kind of not, why it matters. To me, the point is, like, look, we saw a very embedded, coordinated campaign to smear someone as sexist and to smear his supporters as sexist through this narrative of the Bernie bro. Were there sexist Sanders supporters? Yes. Were there sexist Hillary supporters? Yes. Were there anti-Semitic Hillary supporters? Yes. But to me, it's like, if we don't debunk that and the creation of it, and we can point to, you know, Carl Bayer and Glenn Greenwald did really good work on this stuff, how it was created out of like three things that people said. One of them was made up and one of them was a woman talking about Hillary Clinton. But if we don't call that stuff out, it'll just carry on into 2017, which I think is dangerous. And then what happens is, whenever you have a real progressive champion who could actually beat someone like Donald Trump, they will use these tactics. So what do you say? I mean, do you think that that's fair, what I'm saying?
Yes.
Not to be a leading question.
I'll give you the counselor.
Example. This will be better prompt. So on the 26th, this woman, Kara Calavera, tweeted, "Now that I've watched most of the Democratic men and Bernie Sanders bash Hillary post-election, I'm convinced the left has a sexism problem." And I was like, that name looks familiar. Oh, this is why. Because in May, on May 15th, she tweeted, "Wendell Pierce just got arrested for something all of us have wanted to do for 6 months." Wendell Pierce is the very talented actor from Treme and The Wire, Bunk from The Wire, who was a big Clinton supporter and unfortunately got into a fight with a black female Sanders supporter and attacked her physically and was arrested for this. You may have heard of it. Did you hear about this?
Vaguely. Passed me by.
Right. Can you imagine if this had been done by a Sanders supporter to a Clinton supporter? I mean, it would be front page news, and people definitely would have said he had to resign. There would have been unprecedented calls for him to resign. So I tweeted that, and people are like, oh, wow. Yeah, she tweeted that 7 months ago, and she apologized and deleted it immediately. I love the it's so virtuous to do damage control.
Yes.
Big ups to you. But to me, it's like, no, this is still important, and I'm trying to explain things explain to people why it's important to still talk about this. Do you have any insights?
Well, I think it's very important to talk about it. The smears against Sanders as being a sexist were just utterly baseless. The man's record on every kind of women's related issue is sterling. You know, it's just and he never said abortion should be rare like Hillary did.
It's way just to give agency to people.
Yes, one's genitals speak. Only the genitals speak.
Genitals could speak.
it's just so ridiculous, this stuff. It was excruciating during the campaign to have to put up with this nonsense. It was clear that they had no argument in Hillary's favor. The absence of arguments for her candidacy throughout the campaign, it was just remarkable and consistent. And here we are going through this stuff again. And the idea that there's something sexist about trying to understand why Hillary lost is insane. There is just no way that Donald Trump should have won. If you lose to Donald Trump, and again, she won the popular vote, but she's not going to be president, so she lost. If you lose,
she gets that because Gore was the last person who...
Yeah, but this is the widest discrepancy between the electoral vote and the popular vote in American history. And then she, you know, this whole faithless elector thing, she actually lost more electoral votes than anybody, I think, also in electoral history. So, you know, just one disaster after another. It shouldn't have happened. So if you lose to somebody, a comical and dangerous character like Donald Trump, then you really do need to ask yourself some serious questions and stop saying you're sexist for asking those questions. That's evasive and juvenile. And if you were, you know, if you had a shrink, your shrink would, you know, call you on the carpet for not really confronting the serious issues about your life.
That's good. I like that prescription from Dr. Henwood.
Yes.
Oh, the pseudo-feminists are going to have a field day with that. You're pathologizing us. I'll pathologize you guys. I'll take that. I'll take the hit for that.
I think we really need to get serious about how we're going to fight the lunacy and viciousness that's about to descend upon us. And we can't fight that unless we understand how we got here. And the unwillingness to ask those questions is it's really, you know, if you care about Muslims, about gay people, about women, about transgender people, all people who should rightfully be afraid of approaching the Donald Trump years, immigrants. Like, there are just so many people who are going to get really badly mistreated, and not just by the government. If you're a woman, if you're a gay person, if you're a transgender, if you're an immigrant, if you're Muslim, you're facing really frightful prospect of a Donald Trump presidency, and not just because of state action, but by all these private bigoted lunatics who feel now licensed to commit hate crimes and harass people in petty ways on the street. It's very, very bad news. And if you care about those people, and you should, then you should really try to understand why Donald Trump won the election. And if you want to shield Hillary Clinton and as a candidate and the Democratic Party as an institution from that kind of scrutiny, you're not doing any favors to the people you claim to be representing. You're really just hurting them in the long run.
That's great. So how could that, what would that be as a New Year's resolution? Let's frame it as a New Year's resolution. A New Year's resolution for Clintonites.
A good long round of Maoist self-criticism, I think, is what they need.
And they'll do it. You know it. They love that stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No. I think they'll probably, David Brock is going to have a meeting with his funders over inauguration weekend. So it's going to be the billionaires who are going to try to figure out what went wrong.
That'll be good.
That'll be full of insight and full of rich possibility for the future.
And so do you have like a New Year's resolution for him? For Hillary? Anyone? You can throw him out.
She would never do it, but it'd be nice to have Hillary do a serious mea culpa, a really serious self-examination. David Brock should just cut off all his hair and enter a convent or something.
I don't know what convent.
Not a convent. I meant a monastery. I committed a gender crime. I'm sorry.
No, you didn't. You were just presenting it as the construct that it is. You refuse to accept the binary.
Okay.
I got what you're doing.
Yes, that's good.
I don't wish that on any religious housing establishment. Any resolutions for us, for the left?
Well, we need really to get together, and I just feel an urge to bond together socially and politically and hang together and really redevelop all these notions of solidarity, on a kind of large abstract political level, but also on a very personal level, because these times will be pretty terrible. But if we play it right, if we show that we have some answers that the mainstream doesn't, then, you know, maybe something good could come out of it.
Thank you so much, Doug Henwood. And you can hear his show. Check him out on my show. We have great episodes with him. We're about to release some bonus content of him and his intellectual mentor and happens to be spouse, Liza Featherstone. And get his book, My Turn.
Thanks. Thanks, Katie.
So Doug and I talk about the blame game. And you know what, Gabe? I got to say something. Bernie could have won.
You know, a lot of people are saying that now.
A lot of people are saying that. And you know what? It's not just about rubbing salt into the wounds of our enemies. There's some of that.
Although there is something satisfying about seeing very smug people who didn't do anything to reach out to large portions of the electorate.
Mm-hmm. There is. And the ones who told us that they didn't need us, you know, or told people who weren't convinced whether or not they were going to vote for Hillary that they didn't need them. People who are considering voting third party.
People who gave off the air of being mature and somehow, you know, realists.
Right.
The realists that told us that we all had to drift towards the center.
Right.
But really just you can't do that.
And we were people who were pushing voting for Hillary in swing states.
Yeah.
That's Gabe and I did that a lot on the show. We had Becky Bond. Becky Bond was popular vote.
Yeah.
But it's also important because I've found that the same people who keep saying stop relitigating the primary, get over it, look forward, they're the same exact people who look back and blame people. I don't know if you've noticed this, but you have people blaming the wrong people. So they blame third party. They blame Jill Stein. They blame the media. They blame James Comey. They blame the left. You know what would make sense? You could blame the left if somehow we had made a human chain or fence around whatever the airport in Wisconsin is so she couldn't get to Wisconsin. Like, that would make sense. You know what I mean?
Right,
because
she
didn't even campaign there. So I keep thinking of the, yeah, sure, blame us.
And people appreciate it when a politician shows up into their hometown.
Show up, yeah.
I didn't know Jill Stein very well. I didn't know her platform until she came on to our show. And she did the live show. And I'll tell you what, fell in love with the lady.
She's very charming,
because
right?
Because she came and personally was there for me. And in the same way...
Oh, good point.
That's what politicians have to do. You have to be out there. You have to be shaking hands. You have to be kissing babies. And for all of Trump's faults, one thing that as an entertainer I can admire is that he was on tour. He was
on a whirlwind
tour. Yeah. He was giving speeches all over the country. He was doing the thing that politicians are supposed to do. And this isn't me saying anything positive about him other than that's the blueprint for success.
Totally. He looks like he feels people's pain, whether or not he does. He does look like he does. I mean, and he looks like he cares. I mean, and this is people like, oh, you Trump lover. I'm not a Trump lover. But you know what I have to say also? I'm very disturbed. We spoke to Susie Weissman a little about the Russia stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this. Trump tweeted something, I think Friday. And a lot of people are saying that what he tweeted was treason. And it was the following: great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart. And they're saying that this is like aiding and abetting the enemy. Now, by the way, the great move that Putin did that Donald Trump was giving him props for was not retaliating against U.S. diplomats in Russia. So just to back up a little bit, this is something we like. The U.S. government, right? When I say we, like,
yeah.
The U.S. government likes this.
That's our team.
Yes, right? So like all the Obama, everyone, McCain, everyone should be happy that nothing's happening to our ambassadors in Russia, right? And people are up in arms.
We don't want our ambassadors to get poisoned with some radioactive isotopes.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
That's something that can happen in Russia.
It could. It's a Russia thing.
We don't want them to get, you know, put in a theater and then have nerve gas poured into the theater while they're there watching a movie.
Watching some Chekhov or whatever.
Well, Cherry Tree.
Tolstoy. Yeah, nice. Wow, nice ref. I would like to live in a world where the worst thing that Donald Trump does is tweet this. Is like tweet props to Vladimir Putin for not being retaliatory.
Yeah.
God forbid that's the thing that we need to, that's what the resistance has to be about.
Just tweeting foreign leaders all over the place whenever they're not bloodthirsty.
Yeah, exactly. He should do that. Like, good job. Good job of Filipino president for not killing a bunch of drug addicts.
Yeah, great
what
job.
Treason.
Turning the other cheek.
Yeah. But
I like your soft power.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. And Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC is like, the only reason it's not treason is because we're not at war with Russia. Like, oh, To how unfortunate. If only we were at war with Russia. And he compared it to Nixon. There were just these revelations that Nixon, that Johnson knew that Nixon had sabotaged peace talks, negotiations in Vietnam in '68. So he extended the war and many, many more people died and stuff. But like Lawrence O'Donnell was comparing that to this tweet.
Right.
It's the boy who cries wolf thing, right? Like, people are not going to respond to the actual emergencies. It's like antibiotics. You get immune, right? If you abuse antibiotics.
Yeah.
You get, your resistance builds up, and then you can't, when you're going to, if you abuse antibiotics for like a cold, right? Then when you have a real fatal infection.
We're normalizing a hysterical approach to every utterance that Trump makes, so that when he tweets out time to put him in camps, everyone will be asleep.
Right. We'll be immune to it, right?
Yes.
Or not even, the thing is, don't fall for this tweeting stuff. This is theater. Look at the policies. I mean, I guess it's good to, you think Joe Schmo cares about this?
Is Joe Schmo on Twitter?
No, he's not. That's the other thing. These people are so up there, you know what. So also, people, when they are responding to accusations of being Kremlin cheerleaders, here's a new rule. You cannot respond to accusations of being Kremlin cheerleaders by swearing and insisting that you're not a communist. Russia has not been communist for quite some time now.
What's it now, like a petrol oligarchy?
Yeah, I think you say oligarchy like Bernie does. The reason that I think the Bernie would have won thing is relevant is because we still see this primary being relitigated in the DNC chair competition. People who want Keith Ellison, that's Team Bernie, and people who want Perez, that's Team Clinton, and Team Obama, actually, to be fair. We got Obama saying that he could have won, by the way. You saw that. Obama could have won if he won for a third term.
Uh-huh.
And what was great about that is Obama's basically saying, he's not saying his policies are different. He's basically saying, like, I sell it better.
Well,
he's
a
better salesman.
He has the unique charisma.
He does, just like Bill Clinton. They both sell it better.
Yeah.
They sell it better than Hillary Clinton. That's a big difference.
Well, it's interesting, like, even at our live show, whenever I brought up that Obama has deported more people, has the drone war, and that I'm not a huge fan, there's this sentimentality around him. Like, people still have warm feelings towards him, regardless of what he has done on paper, because of how he sounds when he speaks.
Right.
You know, his speeches are heartwarming. But
no, they are.
The
He's
reality
a great, yeah.
is not that heartwarming.
No.
So.
And the danger of saying that, and then you get these people who respond like, no, Bernie couldn't have won. He was a socialist Jew. And there was too much Oppo research on him. The research is like pathetic. We've seen it.
Is it the 50s? Is it just a bunch of like white people with buzz cuts that hate socialism?
And they blew their wad with Obama on that. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's who they said was a socialist. And people really like Obama. Like, we were listening to Keepin' It 1600 the other day. Keepin' It 1600 is four former aides to President Obama, John Favreau, Dan Pfeffer, John Lovett, and Tommy Victor, host a biweekly Ringer podcasts to discuss the political world, analyze the Trump presidency, and welcome commentary from journalists and politicians. And of course, John Favreau was the one who made fun of in WikiLeaks. We saw that he made fun of economic anxiety.
That's right.
And they actually had some interesting observations, one of which was actually that as much as people are fed up with the government, for some reason, they still have a soft spot for Obama. Mm-hmm. But they finally said, you know, some people have come forward, some people who are insistent that that Bernie wasn't electable, or at least they were very emphatic that Hillary had to be the nominee. They've come around and said, you know what, Bernie could have won. So we want to give these people some props. Touré and I have spoken. We're trying to get him on the show. We're in talks. We're in negotiations. Hopefully we won't have a Nixon sabotage it. But Touré is someone who did that. And John Favreau. So what did you think of the Keeping It 1600?
Well, those guys are so smart, and I've always enjoyed listening to them. But they were during the campaign very smug and were the stereotype of coastal elites, mm-hmm. and they make fun of it themselves. And it was great to finally hear them admit that Bernie could have won, and it felt like they were eating crow
mm-hmm.
while they were saying it. And I had a lot of really smart friends that were like, that's the one political show I listen to. And the rude awakening on the day after the election, And it seemed like everything that but one thing that they brought up is that they were working with Obama on his campaign when he was campaigning against Hillary. They knew all of her weaknesses. They knew how unlikable she was. They knew exactly how they would have attacked her and what her weak points were. And yet they still were in denial that those weak points would be in existence just 4 years later.
Right.
Or what was it, 8 years later?
Yeah, 8 years later, yeah. And these people just come back at you with such certitude. That's the thing. Like, no, it's on you to prove to us that Bernie couldn't have won. We have the polls that show that he did better against Trump.
He had more young people energized to go vote.
More independence.
With Bernie, there was a clear message.
Yes.
And the message was reiterated time and time again.
We need to demolish these myths, because if we don't demolish them, then the next time we have a much better progressive person who maybe happens to be a white man, he'll be smeared. And we need to know that the people who smeared Bernie Sanders are not to be trusted.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but it's true.
I'm saying don't look at the chip. Look at the guacamole.
Ooh, what do you mean? Keep going.
The chip is the delivery system, right? Look at the guacamole, though. What's the policy?
Yeah, but you know what's funny? Bernie, people love the chip. They loved his ass. I mean, lots of
people. I think
you love
no,
the chip. No, I do, but I think
there was some Jew-on-Jew love there.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
but
it was your lane, political lane. For me, I liked him because I like grumpy old men.
Yeah,
I like
but
Larry
I think
David.
People like that. I'm serious. Like, I know the thing is that so many non-Jews liked him. That's the thing. Like, why did he appeal to people in the Midwest? He's not a Rust Belt guy. But he was totally, because people like that he and Trump both seemed like outsiders.
Yeah.
They both seemed like they were willing to say the things that other people weren't willing to say. And liberals are so out of touch that they see this as a weakness, that he appealed to angry white men. I've said this before, but I just want to go through quickly the top 10. Let's see how many we got. I'll put the number in later. But the top ideas that have to go out with 2016. I'm so done with them. And anyone who uses who says the following things should be embarrassed because they don't make sense. Okay, no more new rule. Can I say new rule? Because I used to write about new rules before Bill Maher did.
Are you gonna put a hashtag new rule and have it be like a Twitter thing?
Well, I just Bill Maher does that on Real Time with Bill Maher.
I don't watch Bill Maher.
Well, he does. He goes new rule, and I used to do that. And I'm not saying he stole it from me, but I am saying can I still use it if I had it in writing? Like I think I did in Huffington Post before he did it. I can, right? New rule. You can no longer pretend that economic anxiety is totally unrelated to racism, bigotry, and xenophobia. New rule. You can no longer pretend that engaging people who aren't woke is catering to racism or wins elections. New rule. It's not a weakness to resonate among angry white men. It's a strength. You know why? If you're a progressive and you're giving an anti-xenophobia message, that's a good thing. These people literally want these people, like liberal Dems and Paul Krugman, who blame Bernie Sanders for appealing to angry white men. What do they want? They want just Trump to appeal to these angry white men? Do they realize what happens?
Right. Well, you look at we'll take Weimar Germany.
Weimar,
right?
Yeah.
During the Weimar, there was the economic uncertainty. Everybody's freaking out. Everyone's unemployed. And there's a whole bunch of people looking for any alternative. And the guys that showed up with the clear policy and the nice suits, they got everybody.
Can you imagine if like the social justice warriors and the woke Hillaryites were around during Weimar Germany, they'd be like, it's not on me to prove to you. If you don't dislike Hillary, I mean, sorry. Whoa. Oh, my God. No, it's not on me to prove why Hitler's bad. If you don't already dislike Hitler, then that's on you. Or like, what else would they say? Like, whatever. You guys they're going to be demographically irrelevant anyway. We don't need them. Can you imagine?
Right. Demographically irrelevant. I mean, that's, I don't have time for that.
We have too
Who's
much
got time.
Exactly. We have it's too long. And less people think, again, people saying that, look, we got to look forward. It's not time to look back. That's fine. But the only problem is that Donna Brazile, for instance, is putting together a war room to fight against Trump, right? According to The Hill, the DNC announced a new round of hires on Tuesday, including several former campaign staffers for Hillary Clinton, as it builds out a war room, quote unquote, to do political battle with President-elect Donald Trump.
So anybody that was working for Hillary,
who lost, reminder.
I don't know if they learned their lesson.
No.
And so why would you double down on a team full of losers?
Yeah, basically, not the two.
If anything, they should go and try to cherry pick anybody who was apolitically working on Trump's team and everybody who was on Bernie's campaign.
Right. Kellyanne Conway would be great.
They might as well look like what? Hiring ex-Hillary staffers is like hiring ex-Lincoln Chafee staffers.
Oh, my God. Totally. Granite.
It's like when a boxer like needs to make a comeback and they get some tomato can, just like sad sack, beat up brawler right. to come in and just get knocked out in the first round. That's what like anybody who worked for Hillary is going to be like. So why they none of them deserve jobs?
I know. I mean, I feel like that should be like a red flag. Like, oh, we really liked your resume. The only problem is we saw that you worked for Hillary Clinton. But besides that, we just want you to know we think you have a very stellar resume. That was the only reason that we're not going to hire you.
You're great.
You're great.
You guys were in the front of the class the whole time.
Yeah, no, not
and,
so. Yeah.
And you're in the bubble.
So, so they're supporting. Here's who the people are that they hired. The DNC is beefing up its communications and opposition research shop under interim chairwoman Donna Brazile, who said that the new staff's priorities will be to, quote, support an independent and bipartisan congressional investigation of Russia's unprecedented interference in the 2016 election, take on the incoming Trump administration, and protect President Obama's legacy, end quote. And so some of the people being hired, the person to lead that effort as interim communications director will be John Neffinger, a veteran Democratic strategist who will take leave of absence from the nonprofit liberal strategy firm Franklin Forum. Beneath Neffinger will be two veterans of Clinton's campaign. Clinton's former rapid response director, Zach Pacanis, will act as senior advisor to the DNC and will run the war room. Yeah, because when I think of the Clinton rapid response team, I think of nothing.
Those are the guys that changed your slogan like every week?
Yeah, what did they... I mean, you know who they should hire, these people, is Mike Kaska, who was Bernie's rapid response team. Well, Bernie's rapid response person. And he was the one who did that great thing when Hillary was like, where is my opponent? I get a bit of a chuckle every time I think of my opponent. I talk about health care. Where was he when I passed health care? And then Bob Kaska found the link to the video of her literally standing in front of Bernie Sanders and thanking him for supporting her battle in healthcare. And he tweeted literally right behind you. So that's a good rapid response. So we got Zach on the team, then former Clinton's campaign spokeswoman and Adrienne Watson. She'll be the national press secretary. Watson's also worked as communications director for Correct the Record, a Clinton-aligned super PAC. Oh, my God. Collect the Record. That is a David Brock-run evil part of the evil empire of Schmear, the evil Schmear empire that literally trolled everyone online. Like, the Clinton campaign, this PAC put more money, I think, into this Schmear factory than they did into, like, Latino voter outreach.
What did they just AstroTurf and, like, have a whole bunch of trolls and bots attacking people on Facebook?
Yep. On Twitter, really, was where they really were, yeah. And then the DNC has also announced on Tuesday that it had promoted Tessa Simmons to digital director for the War Room. I don't know who she is, but during the 2016 campaign, these operatives focused heavily on digging up and driving negative storylines about Trump. A skill Brazil said will serve the DNC well as it works to, quote, hold Donald Trump's feet to the fire as he forms his new government, end quote. Wait a second. It didn't work during the election.
Right. So they're not offering a positive, progressive, vision of the future. They are talking about making fun of or saying that they're better than Donald Trump. And none of that, was Hillary's entire campaign, was don't vote for him because I'm better than him.
They're literally rinse and repeating the failed strategy. But I'm just so surprised that they're literally like, don't they get, they're so out of touch that they don't even get that for appearance's sake. Like, what they should be is having nobodies who lived underground and were behind the scenes trained by these people, hide the fact that they were trained by these people so that they can sabotage the DNC, which they will, but at least it won't look like they're the same as the last time.
Right.
Like, don't these people get the optics of putting the losing team in charge of the new DNC? I feel like I'm living in the Twilight Zone again.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? Here's the thing. We learn from our mistakes. And to show you that we learn from our mistakes, we're going to put the exact same people.
I mean,
in
if you're not going to change the people, you should at least change the name of the party.
Yeah.
Call it something else.
Or give them pseudonyms. Give them facelifts, like Abby Hoffman changed his face. Let him go underground for a day. Come back up with different faces, different names. Pretend that they're different.
Yeah.
Can we, DNC, you should hire me and Gabe to just teach you how to be effective liars.
Totally. I mean, you can just change your Twitter handle.
Yeah.
Put new avatar up.
Why are they doing this? They're like, you guys, we're really taking a look inside. We're doing a lot of introspection, and we've come to the conclusion that we did everything right, so we're going to repeat it. In fact, you know what?
Well, they weren't the ones that were wrong. It was the voters that were wrong.
It's true.
The voters got it wrong.
Yeah, they really messed up. I can't believe it. This was the first election ever where it was not on the candidate, not on the nominees to win the voters. It was on the voters to figure out why they need to vote for the nominee.
Yeah.
That's good, right? By the way, Hillary's going to the inauguration. That's the resistance. You know, everyone talks about her being in the resistance, like underground. I imagine her like doing push-ups and like training and wearing like war paint. War paint?
Well, I mean, she might wear war paint.
War paint.
Going into the resistance, the underground, I think of like V, where the aliens take over,
right.
and they're all reptiles under their skin, and she's like one of the humans fighting against the reptiles, overlords. Or maybe you're talking about like the occupied French, and you might have the resistance there that's sort of, you know, conspiring against the Vichy government. Or you have the resistance like the Algerians in Battle for Algiers,
right.
Who are, you know.
So which one do we think it is?
Well, I think when you're deciding to attend the inauguration for a photo op, you're not in any of those.
I like that. You know what's cool? I think I think that Hillary Clinton actually wore the same shirt that she wore to Donald Trump's wedding that she did to a debate. So I think she should wear that shirt when she goes to the inauguration, because I joke that she should just wear whatever shirt she wore to whatever outfit she wore his wedding. Anyway, someone tweeted. So I wrote, I actually think Hillary should just wear whatever she wore to Donald Trump's wedding to the inauguration. Someone wrote, I think she should dress as Sarah Connor from the Terminator. Hashtag the resistance. Oi. All right. Thanks, guys. See you next week. See you at our live show next week.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hey, this is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and a system that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible hoodies, t-shirts, and pants right here in the U.S. with American cotton, American factories, and people earning real wages. That's what American Giant stands for, building clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code GIANT20. At American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.